organizing this wonderful workshop and for inviting me. And I apologize for arriving so late. I missed the first days of the meeting, and I will try to catch the slide presentation of the speakers because I would like to update myself. I will present two talks. One of them is a tutorial, and the other one is a sort of critical review. So this is intently critical. This is also why Vidya asked me to come. He proposed me to show this here because we met earlier in France and we had this discussion. And so I just swapped the two talks because for didactic and organization reasons, I thought it was better to first do the critical review and only later to do the tutorial. So today I will give a talk which is supposed to last for about 1 hour, and then we have half an hour for discussion. Please don't hesitate to interrupt me during the talk for clarification and so on, because I will speak about concepts that are related to molecular biology, networks, and mathematics, like graph-based theory. So please stop me anytime something is not clear, and I will be happy to clarify it. I should also tell you that I'm coming from Belgium. I'm Belgian, and I used to work in the Université Libre de Bruxelles in Brussels until last year. And since 1 year, I'm now working in France, in the south of France, in Marseille. So my group in Brussels, these are the people who are still in the group right now. The group is being reorganized. But the people who contributed to what I will discuss today are basically all these people. And the activities of my groups are mainly to develop bioinformatics approaches to treat a different number of problems. And one main focus of my activities since 1997 has been to analyze cis regulatory elements. So analyze genome sequences and detect motifs that are supposedly binding transcription factors and that are driving the differential expression of genes in organisms or according to changes in the environment and so on. So regulatory sequences. From there, I went to network analysis, but in the sense of topological analysis of networks, mainly pathfinding, subgraph extraction, with different fields of application. And one of them is the analysis of metabolic pathways. Another one is protein interaction networks. Another one is regulatory networks. Then other people in my group have applied the same kind of approaches to analyze gene transfer between bacteria or other problems. But the focus of this talk will be on metabolic pathways and protein interaction networks. And Thursday, I will discuss about regulatory networks. So now, the group I joined in Marseille is a group that is involved in genomics, basically. And in this group, there is a combination of experimental biologists, of a technical platform, technological platform that is producing microarray data sequence with next generation sequencing machines. So high throughput production of sequences, and several bioinformaticians who are also developing approaches. So this is to tell you my background. Well, my background actually is I'm an agronomic engineer, and then I made a PhD thesis in genetics, and then I switched to bioinformatics. So this is my background and the point of view from which I will talk, and also the level of experience. Now, one of the things we have been doing is to develop tools for detecting motifs in sequences. I will not discuss about this today. Another thing is the analysis of the topologies of protein interaction networks, and this is a project that started in the early 2000s, and something that started even earlier in 1999, together with Shoshana Wodak, who was at that time the director of the group, was to develop methods for analyzing metabolic pathways. And this is the starting point of the controversy that I will explain today, because at the same time, some large-scale analyses were published, which became really prominent. So I will first explain you the nature of the data. Well, I guess most of you are familiar with the concept of metabolic network, of metabolic pathway, which is a succession of reactions that allows to convert one molecule, called the initial substrate. In this case, you have aspartate, and it is converted into other molecules, and progressively, a succession of connected reactions will produce the end product, which in this case is, well, you can discuss about the end product of this pathway is either methionine or adenosyl methionine, It's an interesting discussion, the boundary of pathways, but I will not discuss it right now. Now, when I say this, obviously it is an oversimplification because, first of all, a molecule is not transformed into another one. It is a set of molecules that exchange atom groups and produce another set of molecules. And many molecules that you see also in the classical drawings of pathways are called side substrates or side products, and they are considered to be bringing something to the mainstream of the pathways or exporting something that is not required anymore for the pathway. So we have a sort of linear view of pathways, or some pathways are branched or even cyclic, like the Krebs cycle, but we see pathways in a way, classically, in a way that is a simplification composed of branches. Now, all the steps of these pathways, not all, but most of the steps of these pathways, they do not happen naturally at a sufficient rate, and you have proteins, enzymes that are catalyzing each reaction, and these enzymes are coded for by a set of different genes. So here, this example is the Escherichia coli biosynthesis of methionine in Escherichia coli. Now, when I show the pathway, I showed you the pathway, it is important to keep in mind that this pathway is not active all the time. Pathways are regulated, and in particular, the methionine pathway in coli is active only under certain conditions. It is active when there is no methionine, when methionine is missing in the cell. And the way the regulation is exerted is by a central transcription factor called, well, central to this pathway. It is specific to this pathway. And this factor is called MetJ. Well, the gene is called MetJ. The factor is called methionine repressor. And basically, it represses all the elements, all the enzymes that are... So basically, what do we do?
The very small
Anyway, you can see it on the slide. So basically, it is repressing all the expression of all the genes that code for these enzymes, either directly, like in the first steps, or it represses another regulator, MetR, which itself activates the two last steps. The last step before methionine. So this is very consistent, and what gives the consistency to this is that there is a feedback. I already introduced concepts that I will use tomorrow or Thursday. There is a feedback, and the first level of feedback is that adenosine methionine exerts a positive action on the repressor. So this is the green act for activation. So once you have the final product of the pathway present in sufficient concentration, you activate the repressor, which blocks the synthesis of all the enzymes. This means that you stop producing the enzymes, but there are still active proteins in the cell. It's a slow regulation. And in parallel with this regulation, adenosine methionine and methionine, both together, they inhibit the activity of homoserine succinyl transferase. And so this is a fast inhibition. As soon as you have enough of the product, you stop producing the molecule. It's a very classical pattern, and you can find it in other pathways. So for instance, this is threonine biosynthesis. The mechanism of regulation is different, but in the same way, you have a negative feedback loop. This is lysine biosynthesis in coli, yet a different mechanism of regulation, but also feedback loops that inhibit the biosynthesis of all the compounds as soon as the end product is produced. And then you can try to understand the logics of the integration of all these pathways, because as you noticed, all of them, the ones I showed, are starting from aspartate. So these are the three amino acids that are derived from aspartate: methionine, threonine, and lysine. And actually, there is a very high consistency in the regulation. I will not discuss today. But once you have done this, you can build map by collecting all the pathways that have been characterized by biochemists since 50 years. And then this gives you this kind of map. So this is a map that you can find in the database EcoSyc, which is a database of metabolism in E. coli. And the map is nice because the annotators made an effort to make it understandable and to somehow, sometimes a bit artificially, split the whole metabolism into human understandable parts. I guess the people who have some notion of biochemistry will immediately identify there. The ring is... And you can see also glycolysis with the characteristic triangular pattern at the phosphoenolpyruvate and so on. So These are patterns that are familiar to us. Something that is even more familiar to some of us, and in particular to biochemists and medical doctors, is this. This was the nightmare of students in medicine when I was studying, because all of them had to learn this map by memory. They had to know it by head. And this is the Boehringer-Mannheim metabolic wall chart. The name is quite good, wall chart, because it is on the wall of many laboratories, plus on the wall of the sleeping room or the WC or whatever of each student of medicine, because anytime they had time, they tried to memorize a piece of the map. This was the good old times. Now we switched to computers, and things became easier to handle for computers, but then this also lends itself to computation. And I also discussed about regulation. I showed you one example of regulation, methionine, but in the same way, people in the team where I made a postdoc in Mexico, in Julio Collado Labo's lab, they collected information about everything that was known about about regulation, transcriptional regulation in Escherichia coli, which is one of the best characterized model organisms for regulation plus for metabolism. So it was a nice choice. And this is a map that is shown, that is drawn automatically with all the data that is in RegulonDB, so this database. And what you see here is that each yellow dot represents one gene. And when this gene is coding for a factor, there is a link between the dot corresponding to the factor coding gene and all its target genes. And so you see that this gives something a bit messy, but you also immediately identify that some factors are regulating a large number of genes, and this is what biologists call global transcription factor or general transcription factors. And then you have many factors that are regulating a very few genes, or a few genes, a handful of genes, and these are called specific transcription factors. Okay, now yet another type of data that you can collect at high density, or high level, high throughput, is protein interaction. So there are several methods that have been developed in the early 2000s. I will not discuss much about the methods. One of them is based on two hybrids. The other one is based on mass spectrometry. But nevertheless, in this case, the goal is to systematically isolate all the protein complexes in the case of mass spectrometry, or all the pairs of interacting proteins in the case of these two hybrid technology. And then you end up with such a map where each dot represents a protein, and each link, each arc represents, or it's not arc, it's an edge, each edge is a link between two proteins, and this represents the fact that these two proteins have physical interactions. They bind together, or at least they were reported to bind together in high throughput experiments. So you immediately see also that the picture becomes a bit more messy, and it's hard to figure out what could be the global behavior of this system on the simple base of its topology. Nevertheless, this kind of data excited the curiosity of people coming mainly from the fields of physics, statistical physics, and computer science. And the discipline, the origin, is part of the sociological raising of this problem. And this was, under other people, well described by Evelyn Fox Keller, who is both a physicist and one of the most prominent historian of biology. And she, I will come back later to that, but she thinks, and I do also, that there has been, at some moment, a sort of clash between two different cultures. And this culture, one of these cultures is the culture of physicists, where an important value is put on the fact to find universal laws, the universality that we were discussing this morning, and biologists, where I think, and this is probably a topic for discussion, that we are working with qualitatively different data because biological data come from history, and you cannot explain them without taking into account the history. So, now let's come to my critical review. So this is a review that we published, and I provided as supplementary material, so I'm sorry to come with an old story, it's already 3 years old. I could have come with a discussion of about Darwin. This is a 150 story. We are not forced to only discuss about very recent things. This has nothing to do with the quality of Darwin's work. We already published it, and I would like to explain you the reasoning, and also a bit of the history of why we started to feel uncomfortable with these theories, up to the point that we finally wrote a review which is obviously destructive or deconstructive, where we deconstruct the whole theory. We think it should be done for scientific reasons, but also it's not easy to do sociologically. I mean, you don't only make friends. Huh? So, the title of the article is The Powerful Law of the Power Law and Other Myths in Network Biology. So it seems provocative, but I take the word myth to the letter. And let's look at the definitions of myth. So a first definition of myth is a widely held but false belief or idea. This is the main sense that I will attach to this word, but you will see also that the second definition, which means a traditional story, especially one concerning the early history of people or explaining some natural or social phenomenon, and typically involving supernatural being or events. Well, I can discuss about supernatural, but there is something about intrinsic or not properties. But so this definition also holds for the last point that I will discuss. Now, to some extent, it became also this myth gave rise to a dogma. So I want to define a dogma because you will show when it comes. A principle or set of principles laid down by authority as incontrovertibly true. So this means you cannot open a controversy about it. Huh? I would like to mention here that the central dogma is not a dogma, it is a paradigm. Huh? What I'm speaking here is really a dogma, in the sense that if you criticize it, the arguments will not be taken into account. By a community that sticks to the dogma, at least, huh, of course. So let's now have a look at the original story. So the story started with this publication in 2000. And basically, this team, the team of Albert Laszlo Barabasi, he's coming from the field of statistical physics, and he's analyzing networks, whatever the network represents. Before that, he had analyzed social networks, internet networks, and so on and so on. And then he discovered in 2000, or in maybe 1 year later, earlier, that biological metabolic pathways, they can be represented as a network. As soon as you consider, as I showed you, that a molecule is a node and a reaction is a link between molecules, then you can build a network. And when they have a network, they like to apply the tools they usually run to analyze network on this network. And then they found that these networks follow interesting properties, several of them. These properties are power law, small world, scale freeness. These three properties have been so popular since this paper in biology that people tend to use these three concepts interchangeably in their literature. They can speak about power law, small world, scale freeness, but they are not able to tell the difference between them. So I will define these concepts. They are related, but they are not the same concept. Now, what is the model? The approach was to oppose two possible generative models for networks. When I say generative model, it is a random model with which you can generate random networks, and then you see if the properties of your random network fit the properties of the observed network. Okay, so this is really the initial step. And so they oppose two ways of generating random networks. One is the way that is a model proposed earlier by Erdros, Reni, and this model is very simple. You first create all the nodes, and then you randomly assign the links between pairs of nodes. So you throw the edges in the network, and it can fall randomly on any pair of distinct nodes. So with this process, the expectation is that each time you throw an edge, a node has a given probability to receive this edge. And so the number of edges received per node follows a binomial distribution, but in this case they describe it as a Poisson distribution, which is a good approximation under these conditions for the binomial. So they say, first model, what they call, well, here they speak about exponential, but this is confusing because the Poisson law is not exponential. Nevertheless, the model that they call exponential, they describe in the paper that it follows a Poisson law, and they show Poisson distribution. This is the figure B on the bottom left. The second model is a bit more elaborate. In this case, what you do is that you progressively add nodes and links. So you create a few nodes, you throw random links, then you create new nodes, new edges, new nodes, new edges, and so on. If you do so, the most ancient nodes will have a higher probability to accumulate edges because they are there for a longer time. But in addition, they impose another rule, and this rule is the richer gets richer, which means that if an edge already has many connections, you will increase its probability of receiving the next connection. And with this rule, what they observe is that it's not working here. Frustrating. Okay. So what they observe is that the network will follow a power law. So this is the graph D on the bottom, and basically, yes, sorry.
So you can use the mouse.
Oh yes, thank you. But you, yes, excellent, good suggestion. Thank you. So in this graph, they represent horizontally the number of connections per node. Oh, sorry, I should have told here as well. So here, horizontally, you have the number of connections per node. So for instance, this node has 3 connections, this one has 2, and so on. And vertically, you have the probability for a given node to have this connection, this number of connections. The number of connections is called the degree in the graph theory. So here, horizontally, you have the degree, and here the probability to observe this degree. Now, what you have here is the same idea, except that here they show the log of the degree, and here the log of the probability. And basically, the idea is that the model follows a power law, which means that on the log plot, you will observe a straight line, which means that many nodes have a very few connections, and a few nodes have very large number of connections. And these few nodes that have a very large number of connections, they call them hubs, by analogy with internet. Now, the interesting thing is that now they call them hubs and they discuss about hubs. Once they use the terminology of internet, all the next discussion is based on this terminology. And now they do the experiment, in silico experiment. They collect all the reactions in a database that was a different database than the ones I showed. It was WIT. But nevertheless, you will have the same with different databases. And they plot here, horizontally, the number of reactions in which a compound enters, either as substrate, this is the in, or as product, this is the out. And then, vertically, the number of molecules, compounds, and the small molecules, that have this connectivity, this number of reactions. And so you see that, not surprisingly, most of the small molecules are involved in a very large number of molecules here are involved in a single or two or three reactions, but a few molecules here are involved in hundreds of reactions. And so they call these small molecules hubs. They also show that this is robust to the choice of the organism. They observe the same in C. elegans, which is a worm. In Fulgidis, I don't remember, I think it's a fungi. And in E. coli, which is a bacteria. And when they mix together all the organisms that are in the database, they observe the same distribution. So far, so good. They have a power law distribution. And then they discuss about the implications in terms of functions and evolution of this topological observation. And the implications are the following. The first thing they do, as good graph theorists, is to look to compute all the distances between pairs of nodes in the graph. So this means the number of steps you need to convert a molecule into another one. And they observe that actually, despite the huge size of the graph contains several thousands of reactions and several thousands of molecules, despite the large size of the graph, on the average, you can convert anything into anything else in 3 reaction steps. For some cases, you need 4 or 5 reaction steps, but basically with 6 reaction steps, you can convert anything into anything else. So this is the property that they called small world property. So you see, power law is this property of the degree probability, and the small world is somehow, they say that the small world property, which is the fact that the inter-node distance is short, they call it, they describe it as a consequence of the small world property, because they say that if a network contains hub, then there is always a way to pass through the hub, and this will enable to shorten the distances between anywhere and anywhere else. Now, what they show also, and this is the scale-freeness property of their network, they show that this average distance of 3 doesn't change irrespective of the number of enzymes. So what they do in this plot, they take each bacteria for which they have annotations, or each of the genomes, and for some of them you have just 200 reactions. For some other, you have up to 1,000 reactions that can be catalyzed by the enzyme that we find in the genome. And They show that irrespective of the number of enzymes that you find in the genome, the average distance between two molecules is always 3, with a standard deviation that is more or less always the same, it's slightly diminishing with the size of the network. So this they call scale-freeness, because one property, in this case the intermolecule distance, the characteristic path length, is not affected by the size of the network. Now, there are other properties that are claimed to be scale-free, and in particular, what they say is that the one property that is scale-free is the power law distribution, and more than that, that the slope of this distribution doesn't depend on the size of the network. They are not very clear about what is scale-free. What I told is in further papers, the fact that the slope should or not be dependent and so on. But in this paper, they are not explicit about what is really scale-free, but this is what allows you to see that there is some scale-freeness. Now, here they do also an in silico experiment, because they claim that, at least in computer networks, the fact to have a small world provides a robustness, or to have these hubs, provide some robustness to random defect, a computer falls down, you can still find another way to go from Moscow to Almora. And this was the aim of the people who designed the internet. It was designed as a network where you can use alternative paths to go from anywhere to anywhere, so that it was military purposes initially, so that if there is an attack on some server, there is not too much central servers and you can't always find a different path. Here, we somehow share the world in two possibilities. Either you have the random defect, and this is what they show in the green curve here. So horizontally, you have the number of molecules that they delete from the metabolic network. And vertically, you have the same measure, the average distance between pairs of molecules. And what you see is that when the number of molecules when you delete one and then two, three, four, up to 60 molecules, basically the intermolecule distance doesn't change. So they show that their network is really robust to random deletions. They call them random deletions. In this case, they use the terminology from biology. Okay? On the contrary, what is very famous is that if you have a network with a big hub connecting many other computers, if this hub is attacked, specifically attacked, then you will increase the distances, you will lose inefficiency of transfer, and all the times of transfer will be increased. And in the same way, they do the experiment with their molecular network. They delete, in the red curve here, they progressively delete what they call hubs, which means the most highly connected molecules, which means the molecules that are involved in the largest number of reactions. And not surprisingly, when they do so, when they delete one, then two, then three, and then up to 60 molecules, the distance between pairs of molecules increases from 3 to 20. And so, then they have an explanation for that, and they say that actually all these properties confer some functional advantage to the bacteria or to any organism, because if there are random deletions, they will not be affected, because they will always find an alternative pathway to build methionine or aspartate or whatever they need. But secondly, they say that the cost to pray for this robustness will be a sensitivity to targeted attacks. And they use the word attack, like in the initial military motivation of internet design. So after that, this paper is published. Yeah. Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah. No. Are there scenarios under which, you know, biological scenarios under which targeted attacks are likely? Meaning that the most connected.
Yeah. So the question is: are there some biological scenarios under which are there biological situations under which the scenario of targeted attack is valid? I will come to that later, because precisely this is one of my points. I think that this does not at all fit to the biological object they are describing. There is a small subtlety there. But to answer directly your question, I have no idea about it. But let's think about it if we can find a case. But the case they analyze here does not lend itself to this analogy. Now, I would be interested if you find a good example of a case where there is a targeted attack. Maybe not in genetics. I don't know. Now, they analyze another network. As I told you, they have a metabolic network, but then 1 year later, they find another thing that looks like a network. It is the protein interaction network. And then they describe this network. It is less fuzzy than the one I showed you, because this was the 2001 version of the protein interaction networks, and in the meantime, they characterized it more exhaustively. Okay? But nevertheless, they observe the same property when they plot here the degree and vertically, well, the log of the degree and vertically the log of the probability of this degree. You have a beautiful power law. And here what they show in addition is that here, if you put horizontally the number of links, so the degree, and vertically the percentage of essential proteins, so they dispose of a database of lethality for all the yeast genes. And so they compute the percentage of the genes that are for which a single mutation is lethal. And what they show is that those proteins that have the highest number of connections are, in general, more sensitive to mutations. The mutations are generally lethal, whereas much higher than for the proteins that have a few interactions. So there is a beautiful story to build there. I will not discuss about hierarchies and so on. Now, the fact is that these two publications stimulated such an enthusiasm in biologists that from that moment there were hundreds of publications about the power law, scale freeness, and so on and so on. And people basically started to find them everywhere they looked for it. And to such an extent that in 2004, in a review in Nature Review Genetics, Albert Laszlo Barabasi published in this review, he summarized what he had discovered, and he says that the cellular networks are governed by universal laws, and that this could potentially revolutionize our view of biology and disease pathologies in the 21st century. So there is also a pragmatical, there is a scientific revolution, explicitly, he says, what I discovered will drive a scientific revolution. So, and in addition, there will be practical implications for medicine and biology. Now, in 2009, there was a special issue of Science on networks, network analysis in various domains, and the introduction of this special issue was dedicated to, he was invited to write the introduction, and he writes, scale-free networks, a decade and beyond. And then again, he speaks about the universality. He says that an avalanche of research has shown that these properties that he discovered occur in all the biological networks, but not only in biological networks, in other networks as well. And he says that network theory will become a common paradigm. So now we are explicitly speaking about a paradigm. And also he says he proposed a new science called network science. Network science, a new research field with its distinct set of challenges and accomplishments. So we have now a new science. And in the same issue, you have another paper about socio-ecological networks, taking the same theories of Barabasi. Another one about predicting the behavior of techno-social systems. Another one about human connections, planes and the internet and so on. Another one about ecological connection, ecosystems. Which species predates which other species and so on. Another one about economic network, yet another one about counter-terrorism, because even the networks of communication between terrorists follow the same rules, the universal rules, and you can use this knowledge in order to fight against terrorism. So now we are really in front of a sociological event, which is quite important, starting from the field of computer science and statistical physics, they analyze social networks and internet networks and biological networks and so on, and now we have universal laws. This is the place where I say that somehow this idea of something that is supernatural can come, because we are not anymore, we are now in front of such a belief that there is something that must be transcendent, that must come from above any system. All the systems, biological, human-driven, have to comply to these laws. Yes?
Would you say the same of the central limit theorem?
Sorry?
Would you say the same of the central limit theorem?
No, not at all. The central limit theorem is a theory. It's not a dogma. The central limit theorem in statistics?
Yeah.
Sorry. The central limit theorem. The central limit theorem, I don't really see the point. The relationship with this, but we can discuss later. Central limit theorem is the fact that if you take either the average or the sum of numbers that come from any distribution, the distribution of the average will tend towards a normal. But I think this is easy to observe and to confirm, no? Yeah. There was another question? Okay. Yeah. So, now I will analyze these five, well, these all these claims, and show you that we are really in front of myth, in the proper sense. Okay? So the first myth is that the degree description of biological networks follows a power law. Actually, they don't follow a power law, and it has been demonstrated in several articles. Yes?
Is there a characteristic distribution that the network, which is the final one to which all the assemblages converge?
Follows.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Jack, could you repeat that?
Yeah, so is there a distribution that the claim network
followed
according to this rule? Yes, the distribution is this. It is the power law distribution. It is the one that is on the graph D here. So this is the whole story. But it's not. You cannot speak about the distribution of the network. The network is just a set of nodes linked by a set of edges. What they measure is the distribution of some property of the network. And this property in this case is the degree, which means the number of connections in which each node is involved. So a first remark is that...
Yeah. Maybe you should go on and...
Yeah, we'll go on.
Because the whole thing is tied up.
Yes. So, first remark. The first remark is that in the comparison they do, what they show you is exactly what I was told never to show in my course of statistics. One graph is in log, and the other one is in non-log coordinates. So it is surprising that in science, this was accepted by the referees. And what is even more surprising is that in many of the subsequent reviews, they take exactly the same picture to show people what they should expect under one or under the other model. And so people really believe that these are two comparable things. Of course, what you can do very easily is to convert both distributions to log-log or to show the initial distribution. So this I did, and I did it for the Poisson distribution. In addition, there is another problem. The Poisson distribution that they show here, Poisson has one parameter, which is the lambda, the average number, the average, the expected mean, okay, the expected number of successes. So in this case, you should have the lambda, which is determining the shape of the Poisson distribution, should be adapted to the network you are analyzing. Now I will show you three types of Poisson distributions. Well, three Poisson distributions with different lambda values. This one has a lambda value of 20. This is about the same as what is shown here. I counted the number of dots, it's 20. Okay. So this is a Poisson with 20 as lambda value. This is a Poisson with 2 as average expectation. And here, this is a Poisson with 0.5 as the average number of successes. In the case of metabolic networks, the average number of connections per compound is this one. So what you should oppose is not this to the straight line, but this to the straight line, and in addition you should convert it to log-log, and then you obtain this figure. Yet, it is different. So they could have shown the two opposite models on the same representation, and you would have this, which is the Poisson law, opposed to a straight line in the same graph. Okay? I take it for... Okay, great. But it's surprising that such a basic thing is not even observed by so-called excellent scientific review. Now, the second thing is that actually the graphs that they show here do not show what they say. They don't show the number of molecules that have a given number of connections, because they simplify it. They simplify it by regrouping nodes according by classes, by big classes. They show only 7 points. So basically they take together all the compounds that have between 1 and 10 reactions, or between 1 and 5 reactions. They don't give the detail. Then all the compounds that have between 5 and 10 reactions, then all those that have between 10 and 50, and so on. And they do bins, and they have 7 bins. Okay? So, no. Yeah.
I'm all for what you're saying at the moment, but binning is a basic tool that we use in statistics. Otherwise,
for some things, you use binning. No, no. For some things you use binning, but not for fitting a distribution. For fitting a distribution, you should use the raw data. And this is precisely what you can do here. This is the real distribution. So binning is very useful for many purposes in statistics. But when you have a cloud of points, it is very important to see the cloud of points and to see the fitting on the cloud of points and not on the oversimplification you made of it. And this is the description. And what you immediately see if you display it is that there is not a single law there. There is something that looks pretty linear, I recognize it, and then there is a tail. The tail is obviously out of this distribution, which means there are many individual molecules that have a large number of connections, but this is even more connected than what they would expect from their power. Okay. Now, yeah?
Okay, so you're probably going to get to it, but the more significant departure from their scaling technique is the small degree.
Yes, obviously.
Really,
yeah, because it represents thousands of molecules. Huh?
No,
yeah,
we
of course.
Can't make out what, can you repeat the question?
Oh yeah, sorry. So the observation is that the most significant departure from the law, from the vertical, from the law, if you would intuitively draw a line here, it would be like this. And the most significant departure is that you have many less compounds that have one reaction than you would expect according to the linear fitting. Is this the remark? Huh? Somehow that this departure is more significant than this one. Is this what you said?
Yeah, I mean, there's a curvature, that is what I said.
Oh yeah, it is not linear. Yeah, of course. Yes, okay. Yeah. Anyway, what I did here is to do the experiment. The interesting thing is that in the paper, they do not show the fitting. They do not show the data, but they don't even show the fitting or give a regression coefficient or give a p-value of the fitting goodness of fit test. Nothing. They just show the bins and they say, this is linear, you see it. Thank you. So, this is a fitting. You do a linear model on this and the blue curve is what you fit on the cloud of data. And you see it doesn't fit at all for understandable reason because you minimize the sum of the squares of the distance between the curve and all the dots. Now what you can do is to do, and this has been done by further groups, they said, yeah, we observed that it doesn't fit, but then we can truncate the distribution. And then when we truncate the distribution, and this is the green curve, we have a good fitting. Now you could also argue on the fact to do the fitting either on the probability of the degree or on the cumulative distribution. So these are the curves I show here. And in any case, you can fit on the whole data or on the truncated distribution. You see that here you have this bump that you will never fit on anything. Now, this may be an effect of this metabolic network, but when you do the fitting on the protein interaction networks, you see that the initial networks that they had in hand in 2000 pretty well follows a straight line. If you don't do the statistical test. But then, with the increase of the data, and even in the same year, in 2001, there was another network which obviously did not follow a straight line, power law. And then the 2006 papers, they obviously discard from the power law, but they obviously discard because they show a completely curved distribution. Now, I will go fast. So, well, I have still 15 minutes, but I want to discuss about four other things. So, basically, what you have here is a study that was published in 2005. I'm not the only one to criticize this. Actually, all the people who are specialists of any of the fields, would it be metabolism, would it be metabolic control analysis, would it be statistics or network analysis, they consider that this paper has absolutely no value. But strangely enough, the claim is still valid and these people are still invited inside to open the review on the phenomenon. Now, this is a study that has been published by one group of statisticians and they show that none of the protein interaction network fits a power law. This is another study published by an independent group in 2006 where they took 12 protein interaction networks and they found that none of them fits a power law. And another group in France fits different types of distributions and show that the network of reactions is more likely to be fit by a mixture of Poisson than by a single power law. Now, this is statistical, and you could say, okay, but and so what? It would not fit the power law, we don't care. And this I agree. The only thing that I wanted to tell is that we are in a field where since 10 years, people are claiming that networks follow a power law. Any group that has tested this hypothesis demonstrated that with Bosch's holes, but it is published in physical reviews, statistics and computings and I don't know what, whereas the belief, the myth, or the dogma still is published in science. There is a real problem. Yeah, you have a question. Yeah.
I think these things are based on a finite number of reactions, or there is an assumption that the reactions are finite, the number of reactions are finite. But in natural systems, it would be infinite.
No.
Can we
will come back to that, but I don't think so. Natural systems have a finite number of reactions. Now, the second claim is that the metabolic network is a small world. And this is the worst thing, really. What I said about overload, it's just a lack of science. But here we are in front of completely things that are completely, completely irrelevant. So the problem is that here they computed the distance between any compound and any compound. But they never show the names of the hubs. If you look at the names of the hubs, I can tell you this one, the name is H2O. This one is ATP, and so on. So, yes, but you don't see it in the article because not a single name of molecule is cited. So I wrote to them and I asked, did you remove these molecules and so on? They didn't. They did it in a further paper in 2003, but at that time they didn't. So, no, these are the names of the molecule, and you can see them. You have water, NAD+, H+, and so on and so on. So this means that when they are looking for pathways from one molecule to another one in order to compute the distance, what you obtain, for instance, if you look for the path between glucose and ethanol, is that you can convert, there are many ways, I show only the 10 shortest paths, of converting glucose to ethanol, passing by water, NADH, and so on and so on. So here, it's not only a myth or a dogma, it's a miracle, because you can convert water in alcohol in one step. Which has been done in the past, but only once. Now, what we did at that time is to... At that time, we were precisely working on that. How can we find relevant pathways in metabolic pathway in metabolic networks? And we obviously felt on this stupid thing, and so we tried to find ways to circumvent it. One strategy that we adopted was to remove all these stupid compounds from the network, so water, NAD+, and so on. It's a real approximation. Don't shout. So, and then you obtain pathways that are... So now I take aspartic acid to methionine. This is what you obtain with the raw graph, where all the molecules are there. And then if you suppress all those molecules that you would not like, generally not like to see as intermediate, then you obtain something that is less shocking, but still not the right pathway. And then what we did is another approach, where instead of removing molecules from the network, we assign a penalty, which is proportional to the degree. And then if you look for the shortest path, or the lightest path between aspartic acid and methionine, you'll find that the 5 shortest paths correspond pretty well to coli pathway, and the 5th one is exactly the yeast pathway. So this means that you can find pathways in this network that are relevant, but this is not what they did. Because they never looked at a pathway with the eye of a biologist or a biochemist. Now, we did a systematic evaluation of this. And if you do the path finding in the raw graph, the correspondence between the path that you find and the annotated pathways is about 30%. If you suppress 36 molecules from the network, then you increase the accuracy to 66%. And if you use the weighted approach that I said, so you assign a penalty, like when you go from Paris to Bangalore, you need to add up the length of the roads and not just count the number of cities. If you do so, you have 83% of accuracy. So, well, this is very rudimentary. We went further in the research, but if you compute now the distances between molecules, you see that in the raw graph, indeed, you have a distance of 2-3. In the what we call filter graph, where we remove compounds, the distance increases to 5. And then in the weighted graph, it increases to 9. I don't claim that 9 is a big distance. There was also a paper independently published by Arita, a Japanese biochemist, computer scientist. And he took a completely different approach to the same problem. By tracing the atoms inside each reaction. He made a huge work of annotating for each reaction which atomic group is transferred from one molecule to another one. So these are the small colors that you see on the atomic groups there. And then he did the pathfinding and he showed also that the metabolic world is not so small. This is the title of his paper. So, scale freeness I skip. I want to come to the functional implications. So, I skip for reasons of time. We can come back, but it's a bit more detailed. No. This idea that small worlds are tolerant to random deletions but vulnerable to targeted attacks, and this is a bit your question. So the only problem is that if you look at everything we know in biochemistry, we have several thousands of publications showing the opposite. Because basically, how do we know that MET A is involved in methionine biosynthesis? We know it because in the 50s, biochemists were doing random or molecular, molecular geneticists, well, geneticists, biochemists and geneticists, they were doing random mutations by X-rays in the bacterial genome, and they were selecting bacteria that are unable to grow in absence of methionine. So this is called a phenotype of auxotrophy. Auxotrophy means that you depend on the providing of some molecule in order to grow. And these auxotrophy experiments each time allowed to point out one enzyme that was missing in this bacteria. And this is how they further characterize the enzyme and show that this enzyme is catalyzing this step and so on and so on. So we have thousands of experiments showing that if you suppress this enzyme, the pathway does not work. And if you suppress this other one, it does not work. It basically, the even fact that we discovered this pathway by this random mutagenesis approach shows that there is no redundancy. That when you suppress a single enzyme in most pathways, when you suppress a single enzyme in the middle of the path, you cannot find an alternative pathway. But in addition, and this is more funny, here I'm speaking about the deletions that are coming in your mind when I tell you metabolic networks are robust to random deletions. Because for the biologist, the deletion is the deletion of a gene. But the nodes of their networks, they are not enzymes, they are not reactions. What they consider as nodes in their networks, and what they measure as degrees, and what they use in this in silico experiment as hubs, what they delete from this network to obtain this red curve, are not enzymes or reactions, but compounds, molecules. And so, if you want to do this experiment to specifically target the first H2O, this molecule, actually, before suppressing H2O from a cell, you need to suppress all the enzymes that produce H2O. And as some of you are biologists, you know that if you ask a biologist to generate a double mutant, it will be hard to maintain it in culture, even in the protected conditions of a petri dish in a laboratory where you want to select this mutant by helping it with some resistance to antibiotics. If you need to generate a double mutant, it will be hard. A triple mutant, it will be very hard. And here, what they are claiming is that you should suppress a few hundreds of enzymes in order to target the first hub. And then if you want to target the second hub, you need to suppress all the reactions that produce a proton, and so on. So, I mean, this graph does not correspond to any biological reality. It is a mathematical reality or a computer science reality that if you suppress the hubs from this graph, indeed, the internode distance increases. But first, the internode distance they measure is not the number of reactions that a living organism would follow to convert a molecule into another one. And secondly, what they claim to be a deletion is something that is not practicable in life. It will never happen. So I skip also this about proteins, and I come to the fifth myth, the preferential attachment. So now, they also added to this topological analysis and this functional interpretation an evolutionary perspective. And they said that actually, this since their generative models rely on the idea that if you first create a few nodes, and then you let the system evolve, and then you throw some arcs, and then you add some nodes, and then you add some arcs, and so on, the most ancient nodes will be the most connected. They transpose this model to biology. And they claim that actually the most connected molecules are those that were there earlier in the history of life. And so this is where we come to a myth in the second sense of the definition, a myth which is a story explaining the origins of life or universe and so on. And actually, they claim this. And what is interesting already is that there is a fallacy here, a reasoning fallacy. I mean, and this was denoted by Evelyn Fox-Keller in a very critical paper as well. She said that actually the fact that you observe a given distribution, that she said precisely that there are different ways of generating networks that produce a power law. And she detailed five different ways of doing this that are used commonly by physicists. They have different generative models for producing the same phenotype, under quotes, which is a network whose degree of distribution follows a power law. And so she says, the fact that you observe a power law does not indicate you which among all the possible mechanisms was involved in its generation. So that's just a sort of, they are turning back logical inference. They say, when you generate a network according to this random generative model, you obtain a power law. In the biological network, we observe a power law, and thus, they must have been generated like this. It's just a false syllogism, what Aristotle would have called a false syllogism. Now, another problem is that if you look at the names of the molecule, we also have a problem. Because if we take it to the letter, it means that S-adenosylmethionine, which has a higher number of connections than methionine, should have appeared before methionine, evolutionary. So this makes absolutely no sense. Because adenosylmethionine is built by assembling one molecule of methionine and a methyl group. And now, once again, if instead of looking at global properties and general models, we would look at the names of the molecule, the names of the actor, then we understand immediately the reason why they have this number of connections. I don't know if anyone is biochemist here, but what is the role of adenosine methane? Yeah, I know it because I looked. So adenosine methane is involved in all the reactions where you need to transfer a methyl group from one molecule to another one. It is the universal carrier of methyl. If you look at H2O, it is obvious that it is involved in many reactions, not because water was there earlier in evolution. Simply, well, maybe, of course, we were in a water sea and so on. But the function that water has in these reactions is generally the same, or there are a few functions, and it is to transfer an OH group to a carbon skeleton, to do oxidal reduction, and to do a few things. So if you look at the names of the molecule, you immediately understand their individual function. And my claim is that the property that we observe, which is not a power law, but which people could have taken for a power law if they just close a bit the eyes and they don't look at the data from too close, so this mirage of the power law, actually, it cannot be explained by any universal law, because the way to understand it is as the sum of individual stories of functions. The function of water in all the reaction is this. The function of oxygen is this. The NADPH is bringing energy. ATP is bringing energy. CO2 and so on and so on. You can orthophosphate, phosphorylation, and so on and so on. So each of these molecules, as soon as you have a bit of culture of biochemistry, you understand why it is recurrently used in a reaction, just because of evolution. Because there are not many ways to produce different molecules. There are a few basic transformations that you can do on different types of skeletons, and this has been used recurrently. So even the generative scenarios, they do not fit the reality. And I think for this reason that we should even forget about generating general models. Here, I show you another attempt, but I will skip it as well. In two words, another group of bioinformaticians, what they did is to ask at least to test the hypothesis. So what they did is to say there are different generative models. One of them is the preferential attachment. So the older, the richer gets richer. Another one is the anti-preferential attachment. Another one is duplication divergence. And they propose yet a fourth model called crystal growth. In each of these models, what they do is to measure the distribution, the observed distribution, and they fit a power law. And they show that actually the power law does not fit any of them except theirs. No, but not the real data. They show that it does not fit the real data. Their theoretical model, it does fit. Then they compute also the clustering coefficient and some other coefficients, the average degree of the neighbors of the molecules, and they show that basically none of these four generative models is suitable to explain the topological properties of protein interaction networks. And I think that the task is vain because these networks were not generated, in contrast with physical networks, they were not generated by one mechanism that applies to many entities, but they were generated by the sum of the histories of organisms during 3 billion of years, and of also selection, not only random generation, but selection. This is the driving mechanism, and the only, in my opinion, the most universal concept in biology. It is the Darwinian selection, random variation followed by selection. Then we can discuss about the modalities, the unit of selection, and so on. So I have still 2 minutes. I would like to ask, is there a new paradigm? And maybe I will surprise you, but yes, I think there is a paradigm in the Kuhnian sense of the word, which means that, well, not exactly. It fails to fulfill some of the necessities for a paradigm. But it is a paradigm in a sense of an interpretative framework. Indeed, a matrix, what Kuhn also called a matrix. Indeed, the people who are in this movement, and it is really a social group, the people who are working in this field of topological analysis of networks, usually they analyze things according to this focus, and they see what they expect to see. And I was once confronted to a paper where the people observed the description that does not follow the power law, and they said, the description does not follow the power law, but this is because our data is incomplete. And when it will be complete, it will follow the power law. And here we are really in front of a dogma, because it means when the data does not, when the model does not fit the data, instead of questioning the model, you question the data.
Normal science.
Normal science. I don't know, I wouldn't say that. Ah, no. I mean, the fact that you have a paradigm and an interpretative framework is indeed both the strength of science, because it helps you to go further, but also some weakness, because it closes a bit your eye to novelties.
But
so
that's what Thomas Kuhn called normal science.
Ah, that's what he called normal science, yes, probably.
No. What you are referring to now need a paradigm shift.
Yes, but the paradigm shift, we are far from it, because the community is separated. Basically, there is a club of people who claim that all the networks follow universal laws. It's a very strongly established cluster of people. But then, nobody in the people who are working in any of the specialized field and who know what they're talking about believes this. And so and this is why I say we are not in front of the paradigm, because what did we learn? Is there a scientific revolution, a paradigm shift? No, because we did not learn anything. Also, this didn't shed any light on, I don't know of any article where people said, no, we understand the biological question that was raised before, and we didn't understand it before, and now we understand it. This is a paradigm shift. Darwinian theory, the typical example of paradigm, it was the case. People were confronted to the monsters that they escaped from Paris, to the different fossils, to the difficulty to draw boundaries between species, and all this, which made difficulties for the small boxes that biologists like to draw in a fixist approach. All this was explained by this proposal of Darwin that species are transformed along the generations by random variation or accidental variations he used, plus selection. So I think we are not in the case of paradigm. But I mean, you can say that the geocentric model was a paradigm. A paradigm doesn't mean something good. It means just one way of interpreting everything you see. And now, I already discussed this. I don't think that we should look for laws. So what should we do? Because when I finished here, people say, this guy, he's working on network biology, he's analyzing networks, why is he doing this? He destroys everything. No, I think that there are many things that can be done, very useful things that can be done in network analysis. But if I had some guidelines to propose, and it's just a proposal, first one is to start from questions, and then analyze data or collect data to answer these questions. Here we are in the case where the data is there, and then we have a model and we try to, it's like you have a hammer. Everything that looks like a nail, you will use your hammer to hit it. Okay? Sometimes something is not a nail, it looks like a nail, but it's a screw. But nevertheless, you use the hammer. And so adapt the approach to the question rather than the opposite. Now, name the actors, I discussed it. Zooming, I think that if we want to understand the relationship between structure and function, what we need to do is to, today at least, is to focus on well-delimited networks, modules, where there is some modularity, when you can isolate a system from the big system, a small system from the big system, and then do a mutational analysis, for instance, or see how the system behaves when you're perturbed, and so on and so on. I will discuss this Thursday about one way to do this among many others. I will show one way of analyzing the relationship between the topological structure of small networks and their behaviors. So thank you for your attention, and now
thank you very, very much for your talk. And then, when you first thought, when you show the raw data, and you that was one of the very early, and you showed there is a deep, flat portion of the data.
Yeah.
If you look, how by binning this portion, can you restore the power law? This is what I don't understand. You say that they bin this data and they generate it. So I don't see how by binning the flat part, you can restore the power law.
Well, if you bin anyway, you will also sum up the other stuff, huh? The connections of the other bins. But indeed, intuitively, you would think that there is not that all these ones, they will now form a cluster that will come up above the preceding bin. I don't know. I mean, I could not reproduce their experiment because the data, the raw data, is not available. And the database, the weak database, has changed in the meantime and so on. It would be interesting. Well, I have other things to do. I already took the time to redo the analysis with Keg and so on, but I don't have the keys of their binning, for instance. I don't know what they consider as the class boundaries. A big problem in binning, it is used in statistics, it is to define the class boundaries, and this affects the distribution, the resulting distribution.
I was wondering about the small world part. Like, if you had a completely random network with the same degree, then what is the expected average path length compared to, you know, the 3 or the 9? Yes. Is it really, you know, 40 versus 3 or 9?
Yes, and this is something that has been done by Alberts, so the collaborator of Bahavazi. They did it earlier. They did analysis of random networks and the distance and so on. And indeed, when you have the power law with randomly generated network, indeed you can observe small world properties. Now, how small is a world? I think that even the world that I showed here, when I used the weighted space distance, probably it is a small world. And how would I know it? I would know it by swapping the network. So I take the same network, I swap the edges randomly, and then I can recompute it. This is something that I could do as a negative control. It didn't do it, but it's easy to do.
Going back to my question, like you said, there are hundreds of reactions which require to be inhibited if you want to remove, for example, the H2O hub. Okay, so if the same experiments are conducted with the assumption that the reactions are unlimited in nature, maybe you get a different kind of scenario. Maybe the paradigm would be true in that case.
Okay, so I will discuss in two parts. The first one is the problem of sampling, and you are right to mention this problem of sampling. We are only working on a very, well, on a limited subset of the effective reactions. No, I don't think that the number of reactions is infinite, properly speaking, because first there are spotting.
It could tend to infinity. You can assume that it tends to infinity, like even in the reactions you have listed down, I can't get
why the average is 4.9 in this case.
But what do you mean by infinity? I mean, the complete number of reactions possible.
Increases. Like,
sorry?
The probability of a node to be attached to another node.
But the nodes aren't compounds, not reactions.
Yeah, yeah, they are the compounds.
So what you're claiming is that the number of reactions that is possible in live organisms is infinite?
Yeah, no, from one compound to another, the network between one compound to another, it could involve...
Yeah, but What is your support for telling that you could have an infinite number of reactions? Because this is surprising for a biochemist, for instance, because you have spontaneous reactions, but not so many. And most of the reactions that are used in living organisms, they are inefficient. They will occur once every 10 years. But then the enzymes, catalyze the reactions so that it happens in nanoseconds instead of years. These enzymes, the number of enzymes is finite. In coli, you have 4,219 genes in the first version of the genome, and among them, about 800 are coding for enzymes. Maybe the annotation is incomplete, and you could say, okay, when we will know everything, even for all the orphan genes, we will come to 1,000 enzymes. So far, so good. But you will never have more than 4,000 enzymes in coli, because there are 4,000 genes, and some of them code for completely different things. So coli, I don't know if you say coli or coli, but coli cannot catalyze an infinite number of reactions. And any other organism will have the same intrinsic limitation that the number of possible reactions catalyzed is limited by the number of enzymes that the organism is able to produce. No? But the sampling, on the sampling issue, there is a sampling issue indeed. And this is something that comes recurrently. For instance, I told you, when people don't observe the power law, they say, but the data is incomplete, but once it will become complete, we will have the power law. I would say this is possible, but then once it is complete, come back and publish your article. In the meantime, you have something to tell. No, as a scientist, I mean, you can say, there will be a law, yeah, it will be there once we will have the data. Okay, start collecting the data. I mean, if I was editor. But apparently the editors did not behave like this. No, I'm joking, because the editor did not say that there was a trap, and nobody could see the trap. Because who are the referees of these papers? Biochemists, but not a single name of molecule is cited in the paper. So they say, this looks interesting, I don't really understand what they do, there is a black box there, but it looks interesting. Computer scientists, for them it's perfect. I mean, you take a graph, you analyze it, they have no reason to think that for a biochemist, the biochemists have such a strangely turned spirit that for them, using water as intermediate between two molecules is not the same as using phosphoaspartate. It is obvious that there is a cultural gap, and this can be filled by mutual work. But there was a good reason for the editors not to detect it. About sampling. This is the fourth myth, or one of the myths that I skipped. So it's a good opportunity to come back to it. There was the team of Marc Vidal made an experiment. It is an in silico experiment. Actually, Marc Vidal is holding a lab of protein-protein interactions. He's very famous for, he's one of the leaders of protein interaction networks, experimental characterization in yeast with different organisms and so on. But he also is very interested in bioinformatics, and he was fascinated by these theories of Barabasi. And so he's a good friend of Albert Laszlo Barabasi. He invited him in his lab for a sabbatical, and they worked together. And what they did is to hire a mathematician who did some in silico experiment. And the idea is the following. They generate random networks, but according to different laws. So they generate one random network with Erdős-Reni models, which generates power law. Another one with the Poisson law. Then they generate a power law network, then exponential law, then gamma, and so on. So they have different network types. And then what they do, if this corner of the graph is the full network, so you have, let's say, in this case, you have 100 molecules and 100 edges, then they take a subsample of it. And they take a sample where they progressively decrease, they delete a certain number, or they select a subset of it, like you do in biology. I mean, you have a protein interaction network, you know that there are 6,000 proteins in yeast, and then there are probably millions of interactions, but when you do the two hybrid experiments, experimentally, you will detect only a subset of the reality. So they said the same. Let's do an in silico experiment where we sample a subset of the network, and then we analyze the properties of this network. And the color code is such that if it is red, it means that the network follows a power law. And if it is blue, it means that, or it is purple, it does not follow at all a power law. So the interesting part is that if you generate a network according to the Erdős-Reni model, and you take the whole network, obviously it does not follow a power law at all. But if you select a small sample of 10% of the nodes and 10% of the edges, you see that we are in the red color. So the artifact, the sampling artifact, is such that when you have a big network that does not follow a power law, if you select a small sample of it, the subsample will follow a power law. So the artifact is about a bit the opposite of what you propose, and what also many people propose to explain why they do not observe the power law. The artifact is that even though the big network is not power law, when you take a small sample of it, you have an artificial power law. But in addition, I remind you that their sample does not follow the power law. But even if it would follow a power law, this still would not mean would not mean that the big network does. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm fine with most of the things that you said, and there's bad science going on here, clearly. We just mentioned the fact, for example, that the first protein-protein networks were produced in the following way. They looked, this was a computer-automated search of literature, and any two proteins that were cited in the same scientific paper were connected by an edge.
Not the ones that I cited. Which paper do you refer to?
This was something that appeared in 2002 or so.
So it's not the first one. The first one is 2000, and this was two hybrid experiments.
Yeah, okay. But, this was admitted in the conference, so I'm not making it. But apart from all the technical points that we could argue about how they plot and so on, I think one should not really throw the baby away with the wash water, as they say. Namely, the way that different protocols, so to speak, for constructing a network can give rise to different signatures in either the degree distribution, clustering coefficient, or whatever, so different topological characterizations of the network, I think gives us an important tool for modeling. And I do believe that null models for comparing biological networks have an important use. Instead of comparing everything with the Erdős-Rényi random network, it is useful to have around different ways of constructing networks which would, on which one could imagine natural selection to have acted. And these null models can be, of course, progressively improved as we find that what we construct does not match with this or that property of the natural networks that we find in biology.
This I take for granted, that a useful thing of this is to propose, at least to open the mind to the fact that if you want to generate null models for testing subsequent analysis, like cluster-based analysis of networks or a comparison between the intersections of two networks and so on, then null models, the choice of the null model is important, in particular for the motif finding that I will discuss Thursday. How do you find that there are recurrent motifs in the network? You need to choose your null model. And when you choose one null model, the motifs will not have the same significance as with another one. Yes, but my problem is not with this. I mean, I'm doing statistics, I'm always using null models, and I'm aware about the difficulty to find the right model for testing the right hypothesis. In sequence analysis, you can use Bernoulli models, Markov models, hidden Markov chains, and more complex models, and the more elaborate you are, the closer from the reality you are, and you need to play with this. So, this is fine. My problem is not that. My problem is the theory behind it, and the fact that you start claiming that, because actually here we didn't learn anything about biology. If it was to say that your null model should fit some property of the data, this is basic statistics background. But it doesn't tell you something about biology. What you learn about biology is what you start doing once you have chosen your model and you compare the observation with the expectation.
Albert?
Yes, Jacques, you took the examples in protein-protein interaction networks and in metabolic networks to show the shortcomings of the approach. What about the other applications to sociological networks, technological networks, epidemiological networks? Is the same kind of criticism applicable then?
So I never analyzed social networks, interaction networks, and so on. I met some sociologists who jump when you say the name of Barabasi, but this is not a proof. I know that he's not well perceived in the field of sociology either. But it could be tested. I mean, the only thing also is how do you build your data in social networks? What does it represent relative to the complexity of society and so on? mean, it's very delicate. There was a paper that a colleague sent me yesterday where they show that there is a genetic determinism of the economical and political beliefs. So the fact that you're more or less left-handed, or left, politically left or right, they looked for SNPs that are, I mean, it's so easy, and in this paper, all the authors are either psychologists or political or social science. Not a single of them is statistician, geneticist, population geneticist, and so on. I mean, we are now generating a lot of data, and we are able to publish a lot of strange things.
Carlos, Mike, here, please.
All right, I think by your narrative, you are implicating that there is going to be a collapse of all this.
No, not at all. I told that the problem is that all the criticism that I show, and it's not only me, I mean, it is statisticians, it's Evelyn Fox Keller, she's someone quite recognized as historian of science and so on, and all the publications that are contradicting this are published in minor journals, and it is very difficult to enter in a journal like this to tell, look, the story was false. Because these journals, they look for things that are original, that are exciting, and so on. If you say, okay, there is nothing exciting there, it's difficult. It is possible. You can do it as a controversy, and so on. Now there is this famous controversy about... but usually, if you want to do a controversy, what you need to have is two opposite schools, like in the kin selectionists and the group selectionists. Now they are in science, nature, and so on. They started with PNAS, with the move of Wilson, and so on. So controversies, they are welcome in these journals because it increases the impact factor. So if you write an article like me, a boring article where you shoot the plot and you say finally it doesn't fit, it's not the same.
You are implying that you can fool all the people all the time.
Yes. No, not all the time. No. I think the community is restricted, so if it is not, what I think is maybe more time is required, because if this does not generate real new knowledge and so on, well, I don't know. I'm not a prophet. But I mean, I wrote to the editor of Science when there was the 2009 issue on networks and so on. I explained her the problem. She said, okay, yes, I understand. You can write something, but 600 words. And this I can't, for different reasons, I'm not.
That's a very good talk. I can give you a couple of examples in ecology where people have used power laws. One is in the context of animal movement. There was a paper in 1999 in Nature again by the Stanbis group showing that some albatrosses exhibit power law movement patterns. The jump links it in the power law. And in 2007, the same published a paper in Nature saying that the nets were entirely wrong.
I think there have been some examples where, you know, geneticists have accepted both the views. I don't know the entire sociology behind it. But in principle, I do agree with you. I think there have been a number of instances, even in ecology, where the number of data points are so sparse, so small, and they claim to be power loss. Now, my question to you is, are there any generic tools available one can use to test whether a data set fits a power law or the general rules one has to follow? I mean, I can think that, you know, some of these first papers were written by physicists, and physicists usually don't do statistical analysis very carefully. Primarily because much of the, you know, output of this data has been so good, this statistics has never been needed. But if you apply the same principle to ecology or sociology or biology, where the data is sparse, I think those things break down and you do need statistics. Now, are there such tools available anywhere else, you know, person who's not an expert in statistics and power loss can go and check if the data is actually following those.
I'm not sure I understand. First, which case is the data? I didn't understand. What is the example where the data is so good that you don't need statistics?
You look at most physics experiments, especially based on
physics.
Yes.
Physics. Yes, but this is precisely my point. Physics is qualitatively different from biology because physics relies on current interactions, on today's interactions, whereas biology actually what we observe is the results of a history. And I think this makes a real difference. And when I say physics, of course, cosmophysics, or how do you say the generation of the universe, is also historical. Eh? But when you think about physics, electricity, or atom forces, and so on, then you have something that happens now, due to the forces that are acting now. In biology, you observe something now, due to the cumulative effect of two forces of random appearance of variation and selection. And so it's qualitatively different.
You're not looking at the question of mechanism. You're saying just poor statistical analysis, right?
Yes. This is precisely my point. But for universal models, that I don't think that a simple topological model would fit a data that results from such process, where you don't only have the you don't only have the mutations and selections in homogeneous conditions. You have the whole history of all the changes of the environment, of the planetary environment, of the interactions, of the movements of everything. No.
Yeah, I show you. There are also systems in physics that have memory effects. I don't think that's a fundamental difference. With the kind of approach that you last articulated, I don't know if you would really stand behind it. You wouldn't be able to model any biological systems. I don't think you would like to say that.
No, sorry. It depends on what you model.
But there is one thing, though, that has been somehow asked and unanswered as well. In physics, the samples of the sample size, when you think in atomic terms, is really so large that it tends to wipe out fluctuations. I mean, even a sample that's a millimeter size has all the order of 10 to the 20 or so atoms. Here, I think there's an interesting issue that's being raised. The system size is small. If you were in this graph that you showed with a tail on the distribution which claims to be power law but isn't, there are these straggling outliers, right? If you had a much larger system, which was built on the same principles, let us say, you would go down maybe three more decades in the probability. That part, which is just showing a few outliers, would sort of settle on the curve, and maybe then there would still be some outliers. What we do in the absence of such infinite networks, right, would be what you suggest, namely, create examples, instances of a whole ensemble of networks built according to the same stochastic principle. And then you would.
This is not what I said, this is what you said. I don't say that.
I know that's not what you said.
Okay.
You said if you had more examples, maybe the thing would fill in. Well, one can generate more instances built along the same lines, and then the thing would fill in. It so happens in that particular example, it fills into an exponential curve. But the difference, the status of the data between physics and biology is in many cases one of undersampling. That's what I want to say.
So there are many things in what you said, but I would like to ring, well, first, indeed, I'm not sure I could stand behind this affirmation that there is a qualitative difference between physics and biology because I'm not a physicist. Okay, so it was indeed a sort of a very speculative claim, which is also proposed by Evelyn Fox Keller in other terms. She speaks more about culture. She says that all the problem comes from the fact that people with the culture of physicists who wants to find universal laws came to the field of biology where things are not driven by such universal laws. Now, I think that the remarks you made are very general. Now, I want to answer one particular question. Why do I have so many reactions for water, and why so many for... I'm a biologist. I'm observing the life that I can observe today, and that is the result of history. And there is an intrinsic limitation. It's not a question of sampling. A bacteria has between 500 for mycoplasma and 10,000 genes for the big bacteria and so on. So there is an intrinsic limitation. If I want to understand how this bacteria lives in its environment, it will not help me to imagine what would happen if I could conceive a bacteria with 1 billion genes, because this bacteria would not be compatible with life. So my question is, I want to understand life, and if I observe some regularity in life, like this molecule is recurrently involved in metabolism, it will not help me to know if the asymptotic behavior of this curve would be a power law or an exponential law. It will not help me to understand the fact that water that many enzymes have derived from enzymes, original enzymes that probably had that are likely to have had the possibility to exert a redox reaction, and then there were duplications of these enzymes, and each of them specialized in the redox of some particular molecule skeleton. This is the history, and this history led to the way organisms today are able to survive in today's environment. I don't even see which question I could answer by analyzing whether the degree distribution of this current situation is better fit by a power law or by exponential or by a Poisson. So my systematic approach is always to start. I'm a very bottom-up guy. So I start from observation, and then I see if I can build up some generality on basis of all the observations. And I know different terms of spirit can be applied to analyze the same phenomenon, and hopefully they would converge. A top-down approach could converge, but my point is always to start from observation and then to see what is the question. And for this question, I build the approach. But here, I don't even see which question would be answered by this approach.
Thank you very much, Jacques. My voice is going, so I hope I make it to the end of my question. I found it fascinating. As a biochemist, I've always been completely dumbfounded by what has been going on in this network field. I mean, if you want to study chemical networks or biochemical networks, which are, as you quite rightly pointed out, a subset of the possible chemical reactions lifted out onto a different time scale by set of enzymes for that particular organism, you cannot forget that it is a chemical network. You're not allowed to forget that, because I mean, people have tried to, for instance, model a chemical network using hydrodynamic properties of a hydrodynamic network, electrical network. You can't do it, because there's one unique property of a chemical network, which is stoichiometry. The fact that 2A plus B can give you 3C. You can't have something like that in an electrical network. And the same here. I mean, a network that has an edge in it, takes one carbon compound to another carbon compound through something that doesn't contain carbon, as you've quite rightly shown, is absolutely impossible. But it seems to, by abstracting in terms of nodes and edges, and then forgetting about the fact that the nodes and the edges have actual properties, you're lost. I mean, you can't deduce anything from such an abstract network. So I hope that you have success in demolishing this paradigm. I'll be with you all the way.
Thank you.
You still not run out of questions, so you have to clap again.
No, it's just a comment. It's not a question, it's a comment. In the early 80s, when Benjamin Lewin was the chief editor of Cell, he would not want any authors to show error bars in their data, saying that Cell cannot publish any paper if the interpretation has to depend on statistics.
This is also a claim that I heard in different contexts in biology. People tell if you need statistics to interpret your data, you should redo the experiment. It means that the experiment was
badly. If you need statistics, it's a bad experiment.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
That's what he said.
What he said? Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, many people say that.
But you know, coming back to this cultural point, there are no questions left. I'd like to put in my 5 paisas worth. I think there is a deep cultural divide between physicists and biologists. Physicists generally take the point of view there are certain laws that govern the functioning of the world, and in whatever I look, I want to see how those laws are implemented. Whereas I think the biological point of view is rather different, as you yourself said, which is to say what is going on, and then can I put it together and figure out what might be behind it all. And culturally, this is a deep divide. I say this on the basis of personal experience, so my statistical validity is zero. There's a 100% error rate there, but this is the fact as far as I've come to see. And it's problematic because there are physicists with very good insights who can contribute to biology, and I think it's a terrible shame that they come with preconceived opinions. The loss is ours, the loss is that of biology.
Sorry, I should do some correction indeed, because my claim is not that we should ban there are physicists in this room. My approach is not at all to ban the physical community from biology. On the contrary, now we are really in a situation where we are generating huge amounts of data, and many colleagues who are coming from the field of physics are doing excellent job in genome analysis, in high throughput data analysis, in network analysis, and so on. So it is maybe the way I expressed this was really a bit excessive. I think that a certain trends of the physical training pushes people to look for universal models, but many physicists, when they come to the field of biology, they first learn the field of biology, and obviously this is what did not happen here. They didn't attempt to see, to understand the biological objects they were working with. Subsequently, they started doing this, because for instance their 2003 paper was with a biochemist, Rabas, and subsequently they made some collaborations and so on. But once the dice was thrown, the direction has been followed, and the claims have been steadily enforced, although they didn't fit the data. But I wouldn't like for the conclusion of this to be that physicists have nothing to do in biology, on the contrary. And we have many examples of very famous physicists who pioneered some of the fields of biology, structural analysis, protein structures, bioinformatics, sequence analysis, many things that are really important.
Thanks very much again.